Welcome to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Good to be with you, Tom. Well, big news coming down late last night. A federal judge ruled late yesterday that Florida's process for restoring voting rights to felons is unconstitutional. Now, we were talking about felon voting rights on the show just last week. Remember that?
Yeah.
And in a 43-page ruling, U.S. District Judge Mark Walker called Florida's system around this a scheme. A scheme, that's a really loaded word. And the judge said that the laws around voting rights for felons are arbitrary, that they force felons who want their rights restored to, in his words, kowtow before a panel of high-level government officials over which Florida's governor, Rick Scott, has absolute veto authority.
Yeah, this ruling, the written ruling, really went after the current process that Governor Scott has put into place in Florida, Melissa. The judge said the system gives four partisan politicians, quote, unfettered discretion. The judge cited a comment Governor Scott made at a hearing that we can do whatever we want. Now, the state probably could be expected to appeal this ruling eventually. It says that they're just reviewing it. The governor's office saying the discretion of the clemency board over the restoration of felons' rights in Florida has been in place for decades and overseen by multiple governors. The governor's statement went on, Melissa, to say this process is outlined in Florida's constitution.
That's right, Tom. But still, this ruling comes as voters will be expected to decide the fate of a proposed amendment to the constitution, the state constitution, that would just automatically restore the voting rights of more than 1 million convicted felons here in Florida. That amendment will be on the ballot in November in the midterm elections. We begin the Florida Roundup right now with a closer look at this bombshell ruling as we welcome Lawrence Mower. He's with the Times-Herald Tallahassee Bureau. Lawrence, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers from wherever you are in this state. What do you think about this ruling saying that the system around felon voting rights in Florida is unconstitutional, that the process is unconstitutional, arbitrary, and unfair? Give us a call at 305-995-1800. Do you think that felons in Florida should have their voting rights restored more easily? You'll get the chance to vote on it this fall. Mm-hmm. Regardless, 305-995-1800. Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Lawrence Mower, this is a big legal setback for Governor Scott. In fact, I've seen it reported today in several places, perhaps the biggest legal brushback Governor Scott has received in the entirety of his two terms in office. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's a big deal, especially because this is something that he instituted. This kind of policy or procedure to get your rights back is something that he changed when he took office. It used to be under Governor Charlie Crist that you could just automatically get your rights back as long as you're not a rapist or a murderer. And then Rick Scott comes in and he changes that so that, you know, they only have four clemency hearings a year. They review about 100 people each time. And so there's like 10,000 people on this waiting list now to try to get their rights back. And, you know, it could be years before anyone does.
And so, Lawrence, when the governor, in response to this, in his statement wrote, the restoration of felons' rights in Florida has been in place for decades and overseen by multiple governors. Is that true?
Well, parts of it, sure. I mean, Florida is unusual in that felons don't automatically get the rights back. You know, like in other states, if you're a felon and you serve your time and stuff, you can automatically get your rights restored. So that part is, you know, going through this process is very unusual. And it's something like 1.5 million people in this lawsuit were basically eligible, according to the Fair Elections Legal Network. They're the people who brought this lawsuit mm-hmm. against the state. And so this could have really big ramifications for a lot of people.
And so now that the judge has ruled the system unconstitutional, we can expect the governor to appeal. Well, in November,
yeah,
people will vote on this. But in the meantime, is the process somewhat in limbo?
No, the process is still in place. And, you know, yeah, it is likely that the governor will appeal this decision. And, I mean, in any kind of federal case like this, I mean, it can take years before it's resolved. The judge, Mark Walker, he's a North Florida federal judge. He asked both sides to come back on February 12th with some ideas on how to reform this process. But, you know, it's likely to be appealed. That whatever comes out of that could be appealed. So it's unlikely that there will be any kind of decision or change to the process before November. It's probably going to be that whatever happens, there's a better chance of something happening in November with the ballot initiative than this case being resolved by then.
Does that ballot initiative make this legal back and forth potentially moot if voters do approve to restore felons' rights except for rapists and murderers?
It does appear so, yes. So that's another wrinkle to it.
Yeah. And you know, Tom, Lawrence, how about the fact that the judge called the system a scheme? A scheme?
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of the language you hear judges and prosecutors use when they're calling criminals into court, you know, money launderers and people like that.
The judge was unsparing his decision. I mean, he said, you know, like you said earlier, that these people have to kowtow to this panel. Yep. And it is relatively arbitrary. I mean, if you don't, I mean, they've had cases where, you know, if you got a speeding ticket, you know, since you, you know, got out of jail, you could be disqualified. And it's really kind of how the governor, who has the final say on all of these, decides, you know, about you. He could ask if you drink today, you know, if you had a drug problem in the past and you drink today, that's been a reason for denying people their rights. So it is relatively arbitrary, and it is very unusual compared to other states.
The judge used a lot of strong language in this ruling. Quote, if any one of these citizens wishes to earn back their fundamental right to vote, they must plod through a gauntlet of constitutionally infirm hurdles. No more, is what this federal judge ruled. Talking about the federal court ruling calling Florida's process for felons to restore their voting rights unconstitutional this week, 305-995-1800. Tom Hudson, along with my colleague Melissa Ross, Lawrence Maurer is along with us from the Times-Herald Tallahassee Bureau and our sister station WFSU. Your phone calls will begin in Miami. JD, you are on the radio. JD, go ahead, your thoughts.
Yeah, hi, thank you for having me. I completely agree with the federal ruling that it's unconstitutional because it kind of mimicked the Jim Crow laws back in the day that would have African Americans go through all these processes just trying to be able to vote. Like that's our right as Americans to vote for who we believe should be in office. And I definitely agree that it's a scheme. I feel that that the right feels that any felon is going to skew left, and that's going to bring down their numbers and hinder them in the future. So it's completely unconstitutional. It's not right. Everyone should have a right to vote once they've paid their debts to society.
All right, thanks for that. Yeah. And, you know, Lawrence Maurer, certainly that was the argument that this coalition of groups that succeeded in getting the constitutional amendment on the ballot this fall had tried to make, arguing that if you've served your time, your rights should be automatically restored.
Yeah, there definitely is a political undercurrent to it. You know, I don't know specifically what, you know, Rick Scott, you know, his motivations are in this, but there definitely is that political undercurrent. You know, there's some pretty alarming statistics when it comes to felons in Florida and stuff. Right now, it's something like almost half of prisoners in Florida are black. You know, that's a shocking statistic compared to, what, I mean, is it 16% or so of Floridians are black?
A much lower proportion of the overall population is black.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that could be considered a political component of this.
And let's go now to Julie in Fort Myers. Julie, you're on the Florida Roundup. What do you think?
Hi, thank you. I agree with JD, and I just was going to say, you know, our votes are the currency of our democracy, and we really need to protect that. We've got so many people in this country who are being disenfranchised, and a smaller number of people are being represented, and a larger number of us are being kept out of the political arena. You know, and kind of expanding on this, if we talk about, you know, the gerrymandering of the districts, and this week I know that there was a kind of a setback on the open primaries movement in our state. Mm-hmm. We need to really be bringing people in to the political process and expanding the ideas and the exchange of ideas in our community so that we can have a healthy democracy.
Julie, we appreciate the thoughts there. Worried about disenfranchisement of not only felons, but also other voters because of gerrymandering and other political and other kind of voting practices here in the Sunshine State. You are listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. Lots to talk about here. Also making the headlines this week, immigration. You know, Melissa, this was a huge theme for President Trump in his first State of the Union address.
Right.
And it was a day before that speech that the Florida House Speaker, Richard Corcoran, released a 30-second ad using the case of a San Francisco woman shot and killed in 2015. An undocumented immigrant was charged with that murder but was eventually acquitted.
A young woman gunned down by an illegal immigrant who should have been deported but was protected by a sanctuary city.
Now, Corcoran's ad released this week does not show any video from the San Francisco case. Instead, on the screen is a white woman in a residential neighborhood walking past a man wearing a hoodie. And in the video, he stops and then pulls out a gun. The camera then zooms right into the barrel as he fires it.
When I heard Kate Steinle's story, I thought about my own daughter, Kate, and how this could have happened to any family anywhere. Incredibly, some Tallahassee politicians want to make Florida a sanctuary state. On my watch, Florida will never be a sanctuary state.
Sponsored by Watchdog PAC.
Corcoran isn't officially running for Florida governor yet, Tom. He plans to announce his decision in March after the legislative session wraps. But he has made illegal immigration, of course, one of his session priorities. The House passed a bill during the first week of session banning sanctuary cities. Those are cities where law enforcement doesn't call immigration authorities when an undocumented suspect is taken into custody. The Senate seems less inclined to pass a similar bill. It has been postponed for consideration until the sponsor, Fernandina Beach Republican Aaron Bean, can drum up more support for it. Now, as we move on to this topic, the idea of sanctuary cities and banning them in the state of Florida, we want to know what you think as we continue the discussion on the Florida Roundup here at 305-995-1800. Lawrence Maurer with the Times Herald and the Tallahassee Bureau there. House Speaker Corcoran has said previously that Florida has two sanctuary cities, St. Petersburg and Tallahassee. Both the mayors of those cities, Rick Kreisman and Andrew Gillum, have really disputed that. What about Corcoran's claim, and what about this ad? Critics of the ad have called it flat-out racist and have called it inflammatory.
Well, it's definitely gotten a lot of reaction towards my colleague Emily Mahoney, who's been writing about it. She's gotten a lot of people emailing her on both sides of this. And, you know, there's a reason. It is a political move by Corcoran. If he does run for governor, which is likely he is, this ad kind of erased all doubts of that. He would be facing Ron DeSantis, who just declared last week. Actually, this ad launched on or basically came out on the day that DeSantis was declaring his run for governor, his formal announcement. Mm-hmm. And DeSantis, of course, has been endorsed by Trump. And of course, Trump, this is a big issue for Trump and Trump supporters. So this is definitely a move by Corcoran to appear more strong on this issue. Now, what do sanctuary cities mean? That's a very nebulous idea, basically. In Florida, you know, the issue comes, at least with this bill in the legislature, kind of revolves around these ICE detainers, which is basically a 48-hour hold. Yeah. So if you've arrested someone, if you're a local cop, you've arrested someone and you suspect they're in the country illegally, you'll tell ICE. ICE, will say, okay, we'll grab them or not. But they have basically 48 hours after police would normally release this person to, like, say, if you're arrested on a traffic ticket, DUI, you might get out in a couple of days.
Yeah,
be released the next day.
Essentially,
yeah.
The local cops agree to hold people for two additional days if the federal authorities ask them to, and then the federal authorities may or may not come over and pick them up. I think about 400 cases of these have been the case in Miami-Dade County in 2017. We're going to get back to your phone calls on felon voting rights as well as immigration here with this ad. But Lawrence, this watchdog PAC that paid for this ad, what do we know about it?
Well, that's Richard Corcoran's PAC. He's had it for a number of years now, and it's been raising a lot of money on his behalf. They've spent $95,000 on a first round of ads for this particular spot on Fox News. They're supposedly spending another almost $500,000 through March 11th in North and Central Florida on this ad, showing this ad in you know, Jacksonville, Pensacola, Orlando, mm-hmm. Tampa, Tallahassee, and you know, notably not South Florida.
Right.
Where this
right.
is probably not going to be that popular.
Not as, yeah.
But yet where Miami-Dade County has voted not to be a sanctuary county, has voted to, the county commission has voted to honor those detention requests from federal immigration authorities.
Well, Lawrence Maurer with the Times-Herald Tallahassee Bureau, always good to have you on the program. Thanks for providing your insights on these two very hot issues this week here in Florida. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa, we got plenty of calls on felon voting rights as well as immigration and politics here in Florida. Let's go back to your phone calls in Hialeah in South Florida. Christian, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
Hey there. I'm calling in because of the felon voting rights. At the end of the day, the way I see it is it's nothing but white noise to the populace because it's completely arbitrary whether the felon should or should not be allowed to vote. At the end of the day, the felon's vote isn't going to sway one way or another. The topic being if a murderer or a rapist, no one's in favor for a murderer or a rapist. So the reason why they shouldn't vote, I just don't see it. The reason that they would be voting in the first place would be for either on a city level or national level.
So you support felons restoring that right to vote in Florida, except in the case of murder conviction and sexual crime conviction, Christian?
Completely. Yeah. There's no point to take that away from them. That's completely unconstitutional.
Christian, thanks for your phone call. Appreciate that input.
Thanks, Christian. Del Lawrence in Miami, you're on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Yes, how you doing? Well, basically, you know, I just give you a little insight on the situation. First of all, the way the system is currently set up, you basically have to hire a lawyer. And, you know, I went through that process years ago, and you got to pay a lawyer like almost $7,000, and then you still have to wait like 6 months, so you can't work.
DeLawrence, were your rights restored?
Yeah, they were restored right away, but the thing is, who can afford $7,000 in 6 months without work?
So you're glad to see that the process was ruled unconstitutional?
Yeah, because it's unfair to the average citizen, the average person, you know, to go through that process and not have the money if you don't have the family support.
DeLawrence, yeah, we got it. We're coming up on our time here, but thank you for calling in here to the Florida Roundup. You're listening to the Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening this week. So, Melissa, let's continue on this topic of immigration in South Florida. Undocumented immigrants, they're certainly a reality in the Sunshine Economy, from picking produce and farm fields to cleaning hotel rooms. They work and they get hurt, and then they face the possibility of deportation. But the companies that hire them oftentimes don't face any penalties, according to a year-long investigation by the Naples Daily News. 37-year-old Abignego de la Cruz sliced his finger last year as he was helping build a Tallahassee fire station. After he got hurt, he says he was fired and that his employer refused him any benefits that would have helped cover his medical treatment.
No. Yo soy el mayor en mi casa y soy el último en tener que tengo hijos.
His employer reported him then to the police. De la Cruz was arrested, and a court denied him asylum, Melissa. Mm-hmm. He appealed that decision. He's afraid he will have to leave his one-year-old daughter, who is an American citizen.
That's right, Tom. Now, Tampa Democratic Representative Sean Shaw wants to amend a workers' compensation bill that would include protections for undocumented workers like De La Cruz. Employers and insurers would be required to cover their on-the-job injuries. Currently, those workers may be forced to pay for their own medical treatment. They also risk being arrested, jailed, and deported. Shaw says employers that don't verify documents before hiring these workers should be required to pay compensation and medical care for injuries under workers' comp. Right now, we welcome reporter Maria Perez with the Naples Daily News with more on this investigation. And the number to join the roundup again is 305-995-1800. Maria, thanks for joining us. And as this investigation finds, there are hundreds of thousands of unauthorized workers in Florida, and they're doing some of the state's most dangerous jobs, like De La Cruz. He was working to build a fire station. He got hurt. He's the one who's paying the price. But as your investigation found, businesses rarely are held accountable in this state for hiring these workers. Why is that?
Well, we found that since 2003, when this law was enacted by the Florida legislature, only one employer was prosecuted for knowingly hiring undocumented workers with false documents. The thing is, where employers are only required to request the documents from the workers, but they are not required to check them. So some employers with a wink and a nod, some others maybe in good faith, they just accept the documents. And as long as they do that, it's very difficult to prove that they knew the worker was using false documents. But when the workers get injured on the job, either the employers or the insurance carriers can check those documents and then report them to the police and deny them benefits in many occasions.
It's frustrating to see this play out because, of course, this is the issue in the country right now, immigration. And in reading through this investigative series in the Naples Daily News, we learn how in Florida, whether it's construction workers or farm workers or landscape workers, the people that build the fire stations or put the pipes in the ditches or do the yard work or do any number of jobs where they could get injured, sometimes seriously, these are people that keep the economy going, and in some cases perform work that can end up saving someone else's life, like the guy that helped build the fire station. And there's this hue and cry right now about deporting undocumented immigrants, and yet at the same time, the businesses that are taking advantage of this cheap labor are not being held accountable for taking advantage of loopholes in the system to exploit that cheap labor. And as your investigation shows, Maria, the legislature is not really, although we were talking about in the previous segment, lawmakers are making a lot of hay over the outrage over illegal immigration, but they're not really holding businesses accountable for exploiting loopholes so that they can benefit economically from cheap labor that derives from undocumented immigrants. And the hypocrisy around that issue, I think, has outraged a lot of folks that have read your piece in the Naples Daily News. And what has the reaction been from your readers as they've read these stories about these immigrants?
Well, we have some comments of readers saying that companies should be made accountable for this. We had a reader who wanted to help one of the workers we wrote about. In general, immigration is a very sensitive issue right now, but I think the common and people have different opinions about whether these workers should be here or shouldn't be here, should be provided benefits or not. But in general, the common thread has been that these companies need to be penalized somehow, need to be made accountable. And the thing is that construction, according in Florida, according to some estimates, like about 20% of the workers who work in construction are undocumented. About a third of the workers who work in Florida picking the crops, harvesting, are undocumented workers. So the Florida's economy rely on these workers for some of the most risky industries. it's, of course, many business sectors don't want to have a lot of pressure on checking that they are hiring workers who are here illegally.
Maria, it's Tom Hudson. Let me ask you, just in the case of De La Cruz, you highlighted in your reporting, was he considered an employee of a subcontractor? Was he considered a full-time employee? Was he what you'd consider a 1099 kind of independent freelance contractor?
He was, this is something many listeners may not have heard of. You have these companies that are called staff leasing companies, mm-hmm. or professional employer organizations. They basically go to a small business and tell them, if you let me hire your workforce and I put them on my payroll, I will deal with all the human resources staff. Right. I will cover them for workers' compensation and health insurance and all the benefits. You have to pay me a fee, but in general terms, I'm going to be able to reduce your workers' compensation costs or other costs, so it's going to be beneficial for you.
In the case of De La Cruz, then, in this arrangement, was he paying for medical insurance that 40% of Floridians get through an employer?
Right, like the small business,
right.
that was... For whom that was contracting with this staff leasing company was paying for his workers' compensation coverage.
And so presumably he filed what's called an I-9. I know this is really detailed, but anybody who's been hired, you get a piece of paperwork from the IRS that essentially says you've got to have a certain kind of documents that prove you can legally work in the United States, and that's called,
right.
usually called an I-9 document.
Right. Yes, he did. He did do that.
And so does that become kind of the paper trail that winds up getting lost in all this, and why you haven't seen more prosecutions of companies that
exactly
hire
that
workers like De
La think
Cruz?
It's hard. I think it's hard for people to understand why so many companies are skating away so easily, and why more legislatures are not more easily able to hold corporate America more accountable. That to me is the story here, and why I think your reporting here is so important, Maria.
So how the process now works, companies are only required to get from these workers to sign this I-9 form where they certify that they are legally authorized to work, and to have a look at the documents,
right.
that they provide, which are usually false social security green cards,
mm-hmm.
False social security cards and false green cards. Now, there is a federal online free database where employers could go register and check every social security number provided by workers and see if it belongs to them or if it doesn't belong to them. And the vast majority of cases of workers who have been charged that we found, they would have been picked up by the system.
Go ahead.
But employers are not required to use this system. In Florida, as in most of the states in the country, they are not required to use this or to do a simple credit check where they could pick up probably also the social security number, like the problems that it has. They only are required to see the documents, see that they look fine, and that's it.
And isn't there a workers' comp bill that's been amended or could be amended in the legislature to take into account this dynamic?
There is a story coming from the Naples Daily News that is going to be online this weekend. There is a bill in the Senate presented by Senator Farmer that would make it not being a crime of workers' compensation fraud to present these false documents if that doesn't affect to the claim in the sense of, like, lying about the injury or lying mm-hmm. about an accident. That doesn't have a companion bill in the House. Representative Saul said a few weeks ago that he was looking into seeing how to amend other workers' compensation bills that don't touch on this issue. in a way to make that companies who were not checking workers' documents at the point of hire would still be responsible for their benefits, the cost of their injuries after they get injured on the job. That hasn't, that amendment hasn't been filed yet, and by now the only thing that is that has been filed is in the Senate this bill by Senator Farmer,
a Democratic senator from South Florida. We want to get to your phone calls, Maria. Just hold on a second. 305-995-1800. That is Mira Perez, a reporter for Naples Daily News, behind their investigation looking at undocumented immigrants working in South Florida, injured in South Florida, and then facing deportation. Fatima, hold on the line. I want to get to Gabriel real quick in Miami. Gabriel, you'll be holding on. Let's see here. There you go. You are on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You're on the radio.
All right. Yes, I wanted to talk about how it's unfair for businesses to just get this loophole and get out of the way. Because when they're hiring these people, they have their duty to cover themselves. Whether they're mandated to check if these workers are citizens or legal or not, that's not the question. In my opinion, the question is they chose to not check. And if they do so, when an employee gets injured, it's their duty as a citizen to take care of their employer, of their employee, because that's their job. They can't just escape this and take advantage of the cheap labor that you get from immigrants or from undocumented workers specifically, and not have to pay the price when somebody gets injured just by getting them deported or whatever other loophole they can find.
Gabriel, got it. Not only a liability issue, but sounds like, Melissa, a bit of a moral issue for Gabriel in Miami.
Yeah, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Let's go to Fatima in Miami. Fatima, you're on the radio. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I live close to Homestead. Like, I live in Miami, but I live closer to the Homestead area, and it's very true. I see people from more of, you know, the Central America, you know, area, and they do a lot of these jobs, and they're not stealing these jobs from Americans. I'm American, and it's a job that personally, I'm not going to lie, I wouldn't want to do, but they're willing to do it day in and day out and risk their life. And I don't think a lot of Americans realize what that is.
Yeah, thank you for that, Fatima. And let me ask you about that, Maria Perez, because as your article shows, a lot of these employers, and these are high-risk industries, by the way, where you are more likely to be injured. And you interviewed some of these employers who told you that they like hiring undocumented immigrants because they are so grateful for the work, the low-wage work, that they will work the long hours. They are less likely to complain about the conditions, and it's low-wage labor. And by the way, let's talk about some of these statistics. 29% of roofers, 31% of drywall installers, more than a quarter of construction painters across the country. These are just a few of the statistics that I found, according to Pew Research, are made up of undocumented, unauthorized workers, and they are much more likely to suffer injuries on the job and less likely to file an injury claim because of this threat of deportation. Maria, what about what Fatina said? And also, as your piece found, these businesses don't have any real motivation to do the E-Verify when they're hiring, but they have major incentive to check once the employee is injured. They're very quick to check and deport and call the police once one of their workers gets hurt.
Right. The issue is usually undocumented workers, the ones that I spoke with, many attorneys told me, too, they are pretty hardworking. They are trying to make money. They're trying to support their family. So they will is not a lot of job offers for them because of their situation. They are undocumented. So they are willing oftentimes to do their worst jobs, to not complain if there are safety issues, to do overtime so that they can get some more money, and it doesn't matter if they are tired or not. So, yeah, in many cases, this is a workforce that is more prone to be not given all the labor rights. There is a study from researchers in a Californian university concluded that undocumented immigrants were more prone to suffer injuries, and there are national statistics about that, mm-hmm. about foreign workers, and also they were more prone to suffer negative consequences mm-hmm. or negative responses from employers when they tried to make claims.
Maria Perez, investigative reporter for Naples Daily News. Maria, thank you for sharing your work with us here on the Florida Roundup. We're going to continue with your phone calls in Fort Lauderdale. Doug, you have waited patiently. Your thoughts on this?
Yes, I used to be a boat captain, and one of the rules are if you smuggle somebody in or inadvertently somebody sneaks on board the boat and you come into U.S. waters, guess what? If it winds up getting caught, you pay the price. In other words, the captain or the owner or both. So you have to pay for their jail, their food, everything else, so they're not going to like, nope, okay, scot-free, we're going to pick up the tab. So that's where, you know, if they had done this years ago, when these immigrants came in there, but they didn't. They wanted to take advantage of them, okay? And the bottom line is these people have been here for 15, 20 years, whatever it's been, good model citizens, paying taxes, and their Social Security they will never see because they're illegal. So they had false Social Security numbers, so they're adding to our economy, and now they're going to want to kick them out? That's cruel.
Doug, we appreciate you hanging on from Fort Lauderdale and giving us that perception from the high seas, the boat captain there checking in with us, Melissa, here on the Florida
Roundup. Thanks, Doug.
Lots more to come. How about the foreclosure crisis in Florida? Is it all over? 305-995-1800, the phone number, as the statewide edition continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. It's the statewide edition this hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, how about this? Florida closed down three of its federal housing programs this week. Now, the programs helped struggling homeowners reduce their mortgage debt and get assistance with certain home loans. Only half of the approximately 100,000 Florida residents who applied for aid have actually gotten any. Still, $88 million remains in this big umbrella fund known as Florida's Hardest Hit Program. $88 million. The program began about 8 years ago. It was funded with $1.1 billion from the federal government. It was supposed to end in December of 2020, but the Florida Housing Finance Corporation says the state was able to meet the needs of homeowners ahead of schedule. Florida Democratic Senator Bill Nelson has called for investigations into how Florida is managing and spending this money. Other programs are still available through the Hardest Hit Fund, but they have had just a fraction of applicants compared to the programs closed this week by the state. We're going to discuss this with our guest, Mary Shanklin. She's a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. And Lynn Drysdale, attorney at Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. The number to join the Florida Roundup as we discuss Florida's Hardest Hit Program, 305-995-1800. Mary Shanklin, let's begin with you. How can the state justify closing these programs with $88 million still left to spend and so many people still needing help?
Good question, Melissa. The state is convinced that it's going to be able to spend the $88 million on the three remaining programs, which, as you pointed out, are really just a fraction. One goes to elderly mortgage aid. One goes to down payment assistance. But it remains to be seen whether they'll be able to or not, because they've been behind in spending for the majority of this program, according to inspector generals.
And Lynn Drysdale, you are no stranger to being aware of problems with this fund. In fact, you've followed this for some time with legal aid. This is a program with a checkered history, correct?
That is accurate, and thank you for the opportunity to weigh in. But It's sort of interesting and unusual that there's this perception that the needs have been met, because the foreclosure crisis is far from over, and it's about to get much, much, much worse.
Why do you say that?
Well, because of Irma. I mean, Irma hit the state. It went straight up the middle. And so we anticipate that about 90 days after the hurricane is when you're going to start seeing a flood of foreclosures related to hurricane problems, structural problems with the homes, loss of jobs relating to hurricane issues. So at a time when we're going to need the money most, we're giving back $88 million. Does it make sense?
Well, Lynn, the storm didn't go straight up the state. It actually went on the Gulf side. I mean, certainly the whole state was affected by the storm, but we're more than 90 days out of Irma. The insurance payoffs have been out there. It wasn't much of a structural storm for most of Florida. Certainly the lower Keys were hit by it. And the job market in Florida, the unemployment rate in Florida, as pointed to by the state when it shut down these funds, is, you know, back to pre-recession levels.
Well, the foreclosures are not going to be immediate after the 90 days. We're already starting to see an increase, and the two things that you've mentioned have not had any effect on a decrease in foreclosures. And historically, as a result of what we saw with Matthew, we anticipate there to be at minimum. Already there have been reported statistics showing that at least 48%, there's been a 48% increase in the number of over 30-day delinquencies in mortgages.
This program began in 2010, and it was unrelated to storms or anything like that, natural disasters. This was a man-made disaster. If it were still open, could an Irma-related foreclosure even apply?
Well, the program is meant for people who are unemployed, underemployed, or experiencing a hardship. Certainly, I think Irma-related problems could fall under each of those three categories.
So then, Mary Shanklin, what is the state going to do with this unspent money? It just kind of boggles the mind to hear Lynn talk that people need help, we expect foreclosures to tick up, and yet the money hasn't been spent, and it's intended specifically to go toward this purpose. What's going to be done with the money?
The state still can spend this on people who have applied for it prior to this week, prior to Wednesday, on things such as people who've been unemployed, needing help with their mortgages, down payment assistance, people getting in the application process for down payment assistance. And I would like to just point out one thing. When we talk about Irma and the impacts that's going to have, that's really an add-on. And just as a table setter, I think it's important to note that we are not in Florida with our housing market and our prices where we were back at the peak of the market in 2006 and 2007. And I tell you why that's important. If you haven't gained equity, if you're not above water, if you're not able to sell your house and make money on it, you are a prospect for foreclosure and delinquency. So even beyond Irma, we're still not fully recovered, even though, as you point out, Tom, you know, the job market looks great. And certainly prices are up.
Yeah, that's a huge point, right? I mean, home values have recovered tremendously, but nowhere near where they were. Maybe we don't want them where they are right now compared to where they were in 2005 and 2006, the inflated levels they were back 10, 12 years ago. But that underwater aspect has people, you know, maybe current on their mortgages, but really trapped in their homes because they would owe the bank money if they were to sell them now.
Every week, every month that the values go up, there are more people who are getting financially solvent on the houses that they bought really overpriced a decade ago. So it's a slow process, slower in Florida, certainly, than it has been in many of the other hardest hit states terms of recovery.
We've got a call from Jacksonville here. Jonathan, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I'm very familiar with the hardest hit fund. I'm a realtor here in Jacksonville, and last year I had 12 different first-time home buyers utilize this program. And they were people who normally wouldn't be able to purchase a home. My last closing with it was just last week, And it was a couple who moved here. They've been here 5 months. They were renting a place. And, you know, with the $15,000, they were able to cover their closing costs and their down payment and get into a house for less than they were paying in rent. And so I think it's a great program. In fact, they did say the money expired for that program. However, I was just notified by a lender today, actually, that there was $8 million, I believe, not spent in Hillsborough County.
Okay.
That they're moving to Jacksonville.
Yeah.
For that.
All right. So. Thanks for that. It's a great program, Lynn Drysdale. It's a program that not enough people have been able to access, sadly.
Well, and it's not for lack of trying.
Yeah.
So many of the people who have applied have just not been able to make it through the process because it's so difficult. Over 20,000 people, I think, in 2017 were just waiting for their applications to be processed, and only a couple of thousand over that, of 24 people who were accepted received the money.
So quickly then, in the tiny window of time that's left, what advice do you have for people that might qualify to access these funds?
Well,
is there still time for the people out there listening that think they might be able to access the hardest hit program?
If your application was not completed by Wednesday, you are...
It's too late.
It's too late.
It's
yes,
over.
It is too late.
It's over. Okay.
There is a new city program that's available, but certainly not to the extent of hardest hit.
And just to intervene real quick, for people who would like to buy a house statewide, there are those funds from Doc Stamps that go to down payment assistance. If people go to their housing counselors, the local housing groups.
Sure.
And that is contingent on the legislature not sweeping that.
I see.
Those Sadowski funds as
okay.
they have in years past.
Well, thank you, Mary Shanklin with the Orlando Sentinel and Lynn Drysdale, attorney at Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. Thank you.
Well, Tom, did you see this finally on the roundup this week? It was another one of those listicle things, an online ranking. Florida's part of it, and it got a lot of attention this week, even though the list first came out last summer. The website Thrill List ranked all 50 states best to worst.
Yeah, you know, these things happen every now and then, right, Melissa?
Mm-hmm.
The criteria, I mean, this is not scientific by any stretch of the imagination. This list was ranked on what it said was the state's contributions to America, stuff like inventions, natural beauty, and what the website called, quote, somewhat productive famous people, all right?
Yeah.
Now, Michigan was the number one state according to this ranking.
Yeah, Michigan, home of Ted Nugent. You know, Cat Scratch Fever.
Sure, yeah. And Kid Rock, too, right?
And Kid Rock.
Yeah.
But I got to quibble with that because not only did Michigan get the top spot, Florida, of course, ranked last,
yeah.
number 50. In fact, Thrillist says Florida's awfulness is so staggeringly impressive that they say it just couldn't go any other way. Yeah, Thrillist, I don't know about that.
We gave the world modern air conditioning. We gave the world Gatorade. I mean, come on. Haters are going to hate, Melissa. Haters are going to hate.
Disney World.
That's right. Absolutely. And plenty of sun. Of course, we did do Miami Vice, among other things. So
I kind of liked the Don Johnson look in the 80s. What do they know? That's our show today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Merchart, they're number one in my book. They're our producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director. WLRN's program director is Peter Mertz. Our original theme music is by my musician, Aaron Libos. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll see you next week.
Welcome to my house. Welcome to my house.
It's my house.